This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, today is International Women's Day, and women all over the world are celebrating achievements they have made despite harsh challenges. We'll have highlights on their stories coming up.
Also, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson today reaffirms the U.S. commitment to Africa, while Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov signs economic agreements in Zimbabwe, one of five stops on a tour of Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: in Sierra Leone, voters are patiently waiting for results of yesterday's polls. 16 candidates are competing to replace outgoing President Ernest Bai Koroma. Among the leading contenders are Samora Kamara of the ruling All People's Congress and Julius Maada Bio of the Sierra Leone People's Party. Over 3 million people were registered to vote in this, the fifth election since a return to multi-party democracy 20 years ago. VOA's Peter Clodi is in the capital, Freetown. Reporter William Eagle asked him for the latest.
The atmosphere is anticipated expectation of the outcome of the results. The National Electoral Commission has announced today that by the end of today or early tomorrow morning, it will announce provisional results of 25% of the provisional results of all the elections, particularly the presidential election. So people are anticipating when the Electoral Commission will decide finally to come out with 25% of the election results as official promise. So going through the streets and markets, people are still arguing. The two main parties, the ruling APC party and the opposition SLPP supporters, have been arguing, sometimes passionately, in the market places where I visited today, Bill.
Yesterday, Peter, I understand there was a little bit of tension. What happened yesterday?
Well, there were allegations that supporters of the main opposition party in Sierra Leone, People's Party, SLPP, who were alleged to have some equipment to hack the system of the National Electoral Commission. So the police were dispatched heavily to the place to investigate the situation at the National Telecommunication Agency, Telkom. The CEO of the agency was not aware of anything. So one journalist alerted him that this is what is happening. He was unaware. He went there. There were some tense moments. However, Amos Sawyer and former Guinean President John Dramani Mahama were quickly dispatched there. They eased the tension and everything returned to normal. The Electoral Commission also came out saying that its system is manual, so it is basically impossible to rig it or to hack into it because it's just manual. It's not electronic where you can hack into it. So that eased the tension somewhat, yeah.
That was VOA's Peter Clotie in Freetown, Sierra Leone. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson today reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to Africa in an effort to end the controversy caused by President Donald Trump's reported derogatory comments about the continent. After meeting with Tillerson today, African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki said this incident has been put in the past. Tillerson said promoting peace and security, development and trade, and good governance are the pillars of Washington's approach to Africa. He also said that the U.S. is not attempting to block Chinese investment in Africa. However, he warned that governments should carefully assess those investments so they do not forfeit any elements of your sovereignty. Tillerson said Washington supports the AU's efforts to economically integrate the continent. Tillerson's one-week five-nation trip focuses on counterterrorism, promoting peace, good governance, and trade and investment. He meets with top officials in Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Nigeria, all of them U.S. allies in the war against terrorism.
Russia's foreign minister has signed economic agreements in Zimbabwe, one of five stops on a tour of Africa. Sergei Lavrov's trip coincides with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's first visit to the continent. Analysts see a common backdrop, the global power struggle among the U.S., China, and Russia playing out in Africa. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg with reporting contributed by Sebastian Mofu in Harare.
The stated aim of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's trip to old ally Zimbabwe was to reaffirm relations and to ink deals that the Kremlin says will cement bilateral ties. His visit also coincided with his American counterpart's first trip to the continent this week. And so the often sharp-tongued official took the chance to slam the American policy of imposing sanctions in Zimbabwe over alleged human rights abuses and other acts of repression. He spoke through a translator.
We are certainly categorically against any unilateral steps, such as sanctions or trying to impose measures forcing this or that country to do something. Such measures are unfortunately in place against Zimbabwe. We believe that these politicized steps distort the market and the countries that invoke these measures interfere illegally within the play of free market forces.
Lavrov also criticized U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson for his view on Chinese involvement in Africa. In a speech before his departure, Tillerson accused China of encouraging dependency in Africa.
Я не знал, что Рекс Тиллерсон специалист по китайско-африканским отношениям, но
I didn't know that Rex Tillerson was a specialist in Chinese Africa. Anyway, I do not think it is entirely appropriate if he indeed said that, and I didn't see any news saying that. It was not appropriate to criticize the relations of his host when he was a guest there.
Analyst Anna Borshevskaya of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy says Lavrov's itinerary tells a story. Whereas Tillerson's visit focuses on countries where the U.S. has cooperated with governments to counter terrorism, Lavrov is visiting former Soviet allies, such as Angola, Mozambique, and Ethiopia.
And there's several things that Lavrov's trying to do here. One is the Kremlin has understood for quite some time now that Africa is important economically and for a number of other reasons. They're also trying to return Russia back to the areas from which it retreated in the turbulent 1990s. And certainly Africa is one of those regions.
Christopher Muchanga, special advisor to Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, says Zimbabwe's interest in Russia is not ideological, but economic.
Russia is a superpower. We are now taking the relationship to a new level. If Zimbabwe can produce world-class goods made in Zimbabwe for the global market, we'll be able to address most of the foreign currency constraints we have and create more jobs for Zimbabweans.
Lavrov and Tillerson were supposed to meet Wednesday as their paths crossed in Ethiopia. That didn't happen, and so the two men will follow their own paths. Lavrov will depart the continent later this week. Tillerson's visit ends early next week. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Sudanese refugee women are trying to rebuild their lives and earn a little money in Uganda's refugee settlements. Some have gone into commercial farming, while others have set up market stalls to sell commodities for an extra penny. Most of the women in the settlements are widows. Others left their men back in South Sudan. Some need extra income to tend to orphans and their own children. For International Women's Day today, VOA's Katrin Nambi takes a look at these refugee entrepreneurs.
Most of the refugees in Ugandan settlements are women and children who have fled violence, insecurity, and hunger in their home countries, only to find themselves trapped in poverty. They get monthly food rations that often aren't enough to feed their families for 30 days. Susan Abiro is a South Sudan woman in the Ailo refugee settlement in Adjumani district. She fends for her family by tilling other people's land.
Me, I have a husband, but some of the women, they come without husbands. Here, we don't have any other things that a person can do. To make it worse, my husband having high blood pressure, he's sick, he's unable to work. That's why all the work at home, even I'm the one struggling, moving up and down, this digging work so that all the children can eat.
Mariam Leary sells snacks at a makeshift market in the Bidibidi refugee settlement in Arua district to pay for gaps in her needs.
To get a money is here is very rare. Unless when we make this one, when people buy, that will be the very way where we shall get a man. And you make this one such that you are able to get a soap, able to get this one a salt, and even to send this whatever, this beans.
In Chiriandongo refugee settlement in Chiriandongo district, a group of about 50 women have banded together for commercial farming. Margaret Deng is a member of the group.
One person couldn't do one field. Mm-hmm. So we decided to make ourselves in groups so that we get hoes. Then we all pile ourselves and then we can go to other fields. Then today when we dig for you, then tomorrow we go and dig for, so that we ease our work.
Deng says other South Sudan refugee women in the settlements should find alternative sources of income rather than depend entirely on rations.
Let's cooperate. Let's join our hands together so that we do something for ourselves, we do something for our children.
Helen Kezinoha works with ISIS Women International Cross Culture Exchange. She advises that refugee aid agencies and the Uganda government should help reduce refugee dependence on food aid by providing alternative livelihood projects. She pointed out that many widows and young girls have had to become heads of households that orphaned children have joined.
This also means that they have to look for other means to make up for the limited food rations that they get. There is no job opportunity for them within the camps. They don't have access to jobs outside because they are not allowed to move outside.
According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, around 85% of the more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are women and children. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the poor are once again paying the price for strife and dysfunction in Kenya's public health system. A nationwide doctor strike shut down all public facilities for 3 months last year, and now a fresh strike has handicapped the nation's largest public referral hospital for almost a week. Ryle Ambor reports from Nairobi.
Rose Ngao walked into Kenyatta National Hospital 2 days ago, hoping that she would be admitted and have an operation to remove a growth in her stomach. 2 days later, she is seated outside the accidents and emergency section of the hospital, contemplating her next move. She says she was scheduled for surgery any day when they give her a date. But now that they're on strike, you never know. She says they're asking her to go to a different hospital, Tumbagadi, to get the blood. The latest doctor's strike resulted from a horrific mistake at the hospital. Last week, a neurosurgeon opened the head of the wrong patient for brain surgery, a mix-up of identification tags, so the wrong man wheeled into the operating room. The surgeon performing the surgery was suspended. More than 700 other doctors undergoing postgraduate training, commonly known as registrars, went on strike in a show of support for the doctor. The doctors are demanding their colleague to be reinstated immediately and for the management to handle the hospital's systemic problems. Samuel Oroko is the chairman of the Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union, KMPDU.
Workers are overworked. Like now in neurosurgery, we have 3 residents, one in casualty, one in theater, one in the ward, and they work 24/7. No break at all. These are human beings who can be exhausted. These are human beings who can be exhausted. And these issues, we are not saying we are protecting anybody. We are saying, as a country, we need to take complete overhaul of Kenyatta National Hospital system.
Surgeon David Kimani came to the defense of the doctors on strike, highlighting the challenges of working at Kenyatta Hospital.
You have one ICU bed. You have three patients who are in need of that ICU bed. How do you choose who lives and who dies? We have only one CT scan to take care of 2,400 patients. We have an MRI that is dead.
A patient at the hospital, Jane Odhiambo, says she had to wait for hours at the hospital due to the doctor shortage. She says the poor people are the ones who suffer because they do not have money to go to other private hospitals. She adds, this is a government hospital that is supposed to help the citizens. The Kenyan health system has been mired in scandals of corruption and mismanagement. In October 2016, Kenyans were outraged when an audit had revealed more than $50 million was missing from the health ministry. The scandal came to light just days after President Uhuru Kenyatta expressed frustrations about the fight against graft in his government. The Kenyatta National Hospital Board on Thursday recalled a suspension letter given to the doctor involved in the brain surgery mix-up and urged striking doctors to resume work immediately. Rael Ombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
Following the defeat of ISIS as a caliphate, the militants are moving to other countries. Observers say they're adopting a new approach as extremist insurgents, beginning with the Desert Army in southern Libya. Patrick Dunleavy is a senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi about the serious threat this development could pose to North Africa and the Sahel.
One of the key factors that ISIS would be looking for when seeking a new location would be the stability of the government in the area that they were going to go. We predicted that countries with weak central governments and significant Muslim populations would be the focus of ISIS. And now the people of Libya have suffered continual violence and destabilized governments since the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011. It's a fractured country run by militias. It's fertile soil for groups like ISIS.
So how serious is the threat of ISIS' new strategy to North Africa and the countries in the Sahel region?
It's extremely, extremely serious because as it seeks to reconstitute itself following its defeats in Iraq and Syria, it is going to those areas that are struggling to have a centralized government. And so even though they might not have the significant number of troops, they have enough members of small cells that are able to infiltrate those countries and continue to exploit the destabilization of the governments.
But after losing CERT, most of ISIS members regrouped in central and southern Libya, setting their own checkpoints, stealing fuel trucks, and attacking General Haftar's military posts. What do you make of that?
Well, a couple of things. In regard to CERT, that was Gaddafi's hometown. And even though the Libyan army had a victory over ISIS and pretty much destroyed the group there, the reconstruction of that city has been slow, and many of the residents are still angry. Many of the factors that led the young men to join ISIS are still there, even though there is a de-radicalization program being run by the Special Deterrence Force, which is primarily Gaddafi loyalists. The other thing in regard to that attack, where 11 individuals were beheaded in the Al Jufra region, was an example of the sectarian fighting between Haftar's National Army and the Benghazi Defense Brigade. Only 2 months prior to that attack, General Haftar's group had just taken control of the area. And now it was seen that ISIS wanted to strike back and say that they were still a factor to be dealt with.
So what should the United States do to counter this new strategy of ISIS moving into North Africa?
Well, first, the United States must be wary of aligning itself exclusively with certain militia groups who are posing as counterterrorism organizations when their only goal is to gain territory for themselves and not help establish a strong centralized government for Libya. In other areas of North Africa, the goal should be the same, to help establish strong central governments that will meet the needs of the people and avoid tribal sectarianism. Tribal sectarianism fuels the fires for groups like ISIS. Military victories alone will not bring a lasting peace to the area. Establishing strong central governments that, again, meet the needs of all the people is necessary. We will never have peace just because we win battles. There has to be a second stage where governments, strong governments, arise that meet the needs of the people in the area.
Patrick Dunleavy is a senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. He was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The UN Refugee Agency says it has been forced to temporarily suspend an operation to resettle African refugees evacuated from Libya to Niger because too few countries have agreed to accept them. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In November, Niger agreed to accept, on a transit basis, Africans evacuated by the UN Refugee Agency from Libya for resettlement in third countries. The UNHCR says it has managed to evacuate 1,400 from Libya since December. The African refugees had been held under terrible conditions in detention centers run by the Libyan government of national accord. Vincent Cochetel is UNHCR's special envoy for the Central Mediterranean situation. He says the UNHCR would like to evacuate more people from Libya, but the government of Niger has suspended the operation because there are too few resettlement departures. For now, Cochetel says the UNHCR has no solution to this problem because only 30 resettlement locations are available. He says that is not enough.
So we've been calling on resettlement states to do more, to evacuate very quickly the thousands of people that have gone to Niger, because unless we have this space, people will have to continue to rot in appalling condition in detention center. We have no other solution available to us.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa make the dangerous trek to Libya in hopes of reaching Europe and a better life. Currently, the UN Migration Agency estimates more than 700,000 migrants, including at least 47,000 refugees in need of protection, are in Libya. Many never make it to Italy, the main port of call, because they are held in detention centers run by Libyan authorities or by smugglers and human traffickers who kidnap and torture migrants for ransom. The UNHCR is appealing for nearly $227 million for humanitarian operations in the Central Mediterranean this year. Cochetel says some of the funds could be used to try to deter refugees from making the desperate journey to Libya by offering alternate options for asylum in countries they pass through en route to Libya. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.